you have the chance to win a Spring Super Sweeps from LAist. Donate $60 for one entry to win a brand new Lexus or $25,000 in cash. Check out all the other prizes too when you donate now at laist.com/sweeps.
It's Air Talk. I'm Larry Mantle. Great to have you with us. As I mentioned, coming up later, we're going to be talking about the Fed's action yesterday, increasing interest rates by a quarter of a point, and talk about what the impact will be here in Southern California. We'll talk a little bit later as well about what's happening at the Pasadena Humane Society. But first, an update on the third and final day of the current job action taken by SEIU, Local 99, and United Teachers Los Angeles, observing the picket lines by the Local 99 members. 65,000 workers total off the job, as well as more than 400,000 LAUSD students also out of class over these total of 3 days. With us to talk about where things stand, we're joined by Howard Bloom, Los Angeles Times education reporter. He is at LA Unified headquarters. Howard, just share with us kind of what the vibe is around the district headquarters.
Well, it's very quiet right now, and everybody is very mum about these negotiations being mediated by LA Mayor Karen Bass. And, that was the major newsy development yesterday, and we're trying to figure out what to make of this. Earlier, Local 99 was very angry at the school district for revealing that they were in informal conversations right before the strike. So everybody's being very close-lipped now not to risk offending anyone. For the week, it's been very boisterous here. There wasn't even supposed to be a major rally here yesterday at district headquarters, but it happened, and the fire department ended up closing off the streets because there were more than 1,000 people here. And the day before, there were easily more than 10,000 people here. Now, sometimes it seems it's more like a UTLA rally than a Local 99 rally. There are so many teachers involved in these protests. But so far, pretty quiet.
And Howard, has the district said what kind of feedback it's been getting from parents for the schools being closed?
Not a lot. We were hoping to get numbers updating, just things like how many employees actually came to work, because if you showed up at work, even if the school's closed, you would be paid. But we don't have numbers on that. There was a delegation of parents not organized by the district that came on their own to Tuesday's board meeting, and they mostly were angry with the unions for – I mean, they were very supportive of what the unions were asking for, but they were angry that the unions were forcing the shutdown of schools, and they were wanting both sides to get together and figure this out. There was a Loyola Marymount poll that recently – I mean, it was conducted in January and February that stated – support for a teacher strike would be relatively strong if negotiations faltered. But, of course, that was in the abstract. Now we're here in the reality, and this strike came on very quickly, caught many people by surprise. And the other thing is, nothing is resolved by the strike. It's not a traditional strike where you stay out until an agreement is made. This was for a set period, and the presumption was that things would still not be settled at the end of the strike.
Well, and Howard, we heard that Local 99 of SEIU might have additional job actions like this if a deal isn't reached. Have we heard any more in the way of specifics what the timing for that might be?
No, and there's two kind of strikes. You can protest unfair labor practices, allegations of unfair labor practices, and that's what we have going on now. So this is not technically related to negotiations, although it's really hard to separate the two, because usually when a deal is finally reached, both sides dismiss their allegations of unfair labor practices, and it's like, never mind, we said you were the most evil people on earth, but never mind, we'll take
now you're our friends.
Right. I mean, everybody has to work with each other at the end of this, right? But the other kind of strike is what's called an economic strike, and that's when you've gone through a very carefully orchestrated process under state law that says you must do this and this and this and this, and then you can have a strike. And where we are in that process is something called fact-finding. So at this point, a fact-finder comes in, and there's a neutral fact-finder approved by both parties, then there's a fact-finder approved by each of the partisans, and they try to figure out what the district can afford and what the proposals from each side would cost. And there's no authority to impose anything, but it's just a way to bring more information to the bargaining table. And then if that doesn't contribute to reaching agreement, then you get to the last, best, and final offer from each side. And then after that, you could likely have a strike. So if it's an unfair labor practice strike, it can happen at any time. If it's a so-called economic strike, you have to work through this process, which would at the very least, I think, take several weeks. But, you know, maybe we'll have an agreement and we won't have to go through
any of that. Wouldn't that be nice? Howard, thank you as always. We appreciate you bringing us up to date on this third and final day of the current closure of the L.A. Unified School District. We appreciate it.
Happy to do it.
Howard Bloom, Los Angeles Times education reporter, joining us from LAUSD headquarters. Also, our early childhood reporter for LAist, Mariana Dale. Mariana, you've been covering how students who are in special education programs are being helped or not getting assistance. What have you heard from parents?
Yeah, there's an estimated about 69,000 of those students in Los Angeles Unified, and it's been a struggle for a lot of parents. These are students that are often getting help throughout the school day. It could be everything from having a one-on-one aide that's keeping them on track for their lessons, to having someone that actually helps them use the restroom and does basic safety protocols for these students. And so what I heard from parents is that what was offered by the district in terms of childcare, these kind of pop-up childcare at schools and parks and rec centers, or you could take your kid to the zoo for free. That's not really something that works for these families, because being in such an unfamiliar environment would be super disruptive. And in some cases, it might not be safe for these students there.
So they're having to come up with alternatives. So were some of the parents saying they have to take off work and be home with their students?
That's right. I talked to one mom, Kathy L., in the San Fernando Valley, where that's exactly what she was doing. She had to take time off work. I think this is not, you know, unique to families of students with disabilities, and that depending on how many resources you have, whether you can work from home or not, whether maybe you have one stay-at-home parent already, it kind of determines how stressful these situations are. And I think regardless of whether you could get care or not, this has brought a certain level of anxiety to these families and to these kids, some of whom still are trying to recover from the disruption of the pandemic.
All right, Mariana Dale joining us, having the latest. And Mariana, now with this being the final day, you can be checking in, kind of see what the fallout of this has been over this period of time.
Yeah, I'd still like to hear from parents about what their experience has been throughout this process. Like I said, this kind of continues a lack of services that some of these families didn't receive during the pandemic as well. And yeah, anyone can reach out to me at any time. You can find all my reporting on our website, LAist.com.
Thank you, Mariana Dale, joining us on Air Talk with the very latest on the challenges parents of students with special needs have faced, with schools in LA Unified being closed starting Tuesday through the end of classes today. And our thanks as well to Howard Bloom, LA Times education reporter, with the very latest on where things stand, talks that have been initiated by LA Mayor Karen Bass.
Imagine if you could charge your electric vehicle at the places you already love to eat, shop, and play. Whether you're at the movies, on your weekly grocery trip, or running errands at your local mall, Volta EV charging stations are built around your day-to-day and located in your community and nationwide. All you have to do is check in, plug in, and go about your day. It's EV charging made convenient. Download the Volta app to find your new favorite place to charge.
Thank you so much for your generous support of LAist 89.3, and also through your thank you gift, Pasadena Humane, the thousands of dogs for whom they provide care each and every year. They're a regional humane society, so it's not just Pasadena, it's the whole region that they serve. Well, the Federal Reserve yesterday extended its fight against high inflation by raising its key interest rate a quarter point. That also, though, fueling concerns that higher borrowing rates could put more stress on the banking system. Joining us to talk about what the Fed decided to do is a reporter covering the Federal Reserve for Bloomberg, Jonelle Marte. Jonelle, thank you very much for being with us. Share with us, you know, what needle did the Fed have to thread yesterday?
So, first of all, Larry, thank you so much for having me here. It's a really interesting time to be covering the Fed. They are facing this very difficult challenge, which is, you know, on the one hand, inflation is very high, as we all know and have been experiencing. It is running much higher than what the Federal Reserve is aiming for, which is for 2% inflation. It's at least, you know, three times that, or two or three times that, depending on the metric that you look at. So they have that pressing issue. And at the same time, of course, we're seeing a lot of instability in the banking system, which is another thing that the Fed is in charge of, or rather, you know, aiming to do, which is to have a stable banking system. So what we heard yesterday when the Fed decided to continue to raise interest rates is that they are going to continue with the obstacle that they know, inflation, and saying we're not ready to back down on our efforts here to bring inflation down, and we're going to keep raising interest rates. However, they are acknowledging there are risks out there. We see them. We're watching closely. And we're ready to adjust, is what they're saying. They're ready to adjust their plan if it turns out that the banking issues turn out to be, you know, in the end, much, much worse than what we're seeing right now.
Well, and if they see that banks aren't going to be, you know, lending as much to conserve cash, did Powell say anything about whether that might cause them to put the brakes on the interest rate increases?
You are hitting it right on the head there. So what the Fed is going to be watching, and what a lot of economists are also watching for, is how does all of this affect access to cash, access to loans? If banks become a lot more cautious and pull back on their, you know, how much credit they offer to businesses, to households, that is not great news for the economy, just to put it lightly. I mean, that means consumers would have a harder time just paying for things, you know, buying things. So it could have a big effect on growth. It could push us into a recession. The Fed has, of course, been trying to avoid pushing the economy into a recession. It's been working ideally to cool demand and cool growth so that inflation could come down, but without having this big downturn. You know, that's not for certain. We have a lot of unknowns right now as to how access to credit is going to change. And if we do see a big pullback in lending, and we are starting to see that, for instance, in the corporate market with deals collapsing, it's harder for companies to raise money. That doesn't bode well for the economy. And what the Fed is saying and acknowledging is that would do some of the work that we're aiming for. It would do it kind of for them. So they wouldn't have to raise interest rates as much or as high if we do see a big contraction in the lending market. On the other hand, if this is contained, then inflation stays high. The Fed also is prepared to continue raising rates.
We're talking with Bloomberg reporter, covers the Federal Reserve, Jonelle Marte. Jonelle, thank you so much for being with us. We appreciate it. What happened yesterday. Also with us, founding partner of Beacon Economics, economist Chris Thornburg, a frequent guest with us. Chris, your thoughts on what the Fed did yesterday?
Well, the Fed obviously tightened, but they didn't tighten as much as they had expected. And so that's why you saw a big drop in interest rates yesterday. So it seemed as if they're backing off. And to be clear, I think I agree with everything that was just said about going on right now, about the Fed choice between inflation and bank stability. What needs to be said is that the Fed put themselves into this incredibly difficult position in the first place. This all goes back, of course, to the pandemic. And as tragic as the pandemic was from a human perspective, it was never the economic crisis we pretended it was. But that never got into the political bubble called Washington, D.C. And the net result is Congress did $6 trillion in stimulus spending to deal with an economic shock that cost the U.S. a little over $1 trillion in economic output. So there was $5 of stimulus for every dollar of lost income. It was crazy. Now, where do you get that money? There's no way they could have gotten that funding from the bond markets. Well, they got it from the Federal Reserve. The Federal Reserve paid for most of that with $5 trillion of quantitative easing, which caused about a 40% jump in the money supply. One of the biggest surprises about inflation is that anybody was surprised by inflation. We've never seen a country expand its money supply by 40% and not see a degree of inflation. Of course, it was going to hit. So then, of course, the Fed overreacted to inflation. They're cranking interest rates up. And lo and behold, they're now starting to hurt the banking system. So what you see really is a central bank, our Federal Reserve, acting in ways that are completely inappropriate from a central bank perspective. And this all boils down, I really think, to the politicization of the Fed that's occurred over the last decade. You know, in the old days, you had boring economists and bankers, people you would never want to have to a cocktail party. And the reason they were there is because they didn't buy into these sort of political narratives. But now the Fed has been completely politicized, and as a result, they're just kind of overreacting to everything, not only Congress does, and they are creating turmoil within our economy, which if they had just been a little patient and taken their time, would have never happened.
So let's talk, though, about where we are now, Chris. So you mentioned the $5 trillion in quantitative easing from the Fed. And now they're trying to contain the inflation that's resulted. What do you think is the best way to do that at the same time not, overcooling the economy?
Well, that's just it. You can't. The inflation horse is out of the barn. Okay, it's long gone. That money's in the economy, and the only way to take that money out of the economy to prevent inflation is to take it out of bank deposits. And one of the things here that isn't really mentioned is the real stress on the banking system right now is not being caused by the hike in interest rate, but rather the quantitative tightening. What they've done is after picking up about $5 trillion of new government debt, they've sold off about $0.5 trillion. Well, that has caused the banks to lose about $400, $450 billion in deposits. And when they've lost those deposits, that means they have to turn around and sell off securities at a diminished value because of the hike in interest rates. So it's really the quantitative tightening that's causing the pain for the banking system right now. And that's the rub. You're never going to stop inflation until you take cash out of the economy. You can't take cash out of the economy without sinking the banking system. Inflation is the only way forward at this point in time. The only good news here is it will burn itself out. I mean, we're halfway through our inflationary surge. In a couple years, prices should re-equilibrate with the size of the money supply, and we're out of it. The question is will the Fed pursue the logical path? Because to be clear, they have far. What happens next?
Chris Thornburg, founding partner, Beacon Economics, joining us on Air Talk. Chris, thank you so much. Appreciate hearing your perspective on what the Federal Reserve is doing now and did previously as well. Chris Thornburg with us. And our thanks to Janelle Marte, reporter covering the Federal Reserve for Bloomberg News.
The LAS Spring Super Sweeps is happening now. You can win amazing prizes while supporting your source for local fact-based journalism. One lucky grand prize winner will get to choose a brand new Lexus or $25,000 in cash. Other prizes include an electric bike from Juice Bikes and $1,000 gas gift cards. Your donation of $60 gets you one entry to win. And the more you give, the more entries you get. Donate now at las.com/sweeps.
It's Air Talk on LAist 89.3. I'm Larry Mantle with All Things Considered host Ari Shapiro. We also know him here in Southern California for his many appearances at the Hollywood Bowl and Walt Disney Concert Hall with the musical group Pink Martini. And now Ari is author of his own memoir, The Best Strangers in the World, Stories from a Life Spent Listening. Ari, it's so good to have you with us today on Air Talk.
It's a pleasure. Thank you for having me, Larry.
First of all, I loved reading about your childhood growing up first in Fargo, North Dakota, as the only Jewish kid in school, and then moving to suburban Portland, where you came out as gay and being different. I wanted to ask you about, you know, being an outsider and how much of those childhood experiences lead to your tremendous interest in telling people stories from around the world.
It really wasn't until I started writing the book that I put two and two together and figured out that connection. But I think there is something about being part of a marginalized group that makes the architecture of society stand in slightly sharper relief. And so it almost doesn't matter whether we're talking about gender, race, sexual orientation, nationality, what have you. There's something about having the experience of feeling othered that I think sort of makes the matrix ripple into view a little bit more and made me curious to understand the stories of people around me. And the kind of leap that I made when I discovered journalism was, oh, these can be people that I have no personal connection to whatsoever that I'm just curious about. And so whether I'm going to a Bikers for Romney rally or a war zone where people are fighting against ISIS, I have this incredible privilege where I get to walk up to strangers with my microphone and say, tell me about your life. Tell me how you're feeling. Tell me what's happening here. And in many cases, they do. And that's like mildly miraculous to me. I don't take it for granted. I started out reporting stories thinking, oh my God, do I sound too gay? You know, which is not a thought that I've had for a very long time. Mm-hmm. And I think that I come to stories that I tell with my lived experience as a human moving through life. So does everyone. So does every journalist. And so part of what I wrestle with in this book is the push-pull between, on the one hand, wanting to be a surrogate for the listener, whoever that listener may be, wanting anyone hearing my stories to feel like they are standing in my shoes talking to the person that I'm talking to. And that makes me want to kind of erase myself from the story. But on the other hand, I view the world through particular lenses, as does everyone. And trying to pretend that those lenses don't exist does not make them go away. And so there's a real tension there. And that's the tension that I was trying to explore in many of these essays.
Well, and in fact, that's part of the revelation, I think, particularly of the broadcast journalist, of the radio or audio stream journalist, because that's what really builds intimacy, doesn't it, Ari? That they do have a sense that you're not just a robotic voice, but there's a full person behind that voice that in some way they relate to and are emotional. Invested in. That's what makes a powerful radio presentation.
Well, both are true. I mean, All Things Considered is not personality-based journalism in the way that Howard Stern is personality-based. There are podcasts that people listen to because they feel like the podcast host is their best friend. And I don't think Consider This, the podcast that's a spinoff of All Things Considered, is that kind of a podcast. So yes, it is incredibly intimate. I'm with people as they make dinner in the evening, as they pick their kids up from school, as they run their errands, as they do things that nobody else is in the room for. I'm in the room through the radio. At the same time, when I am covering a natural disaster, I understand listeners who say, Ari, it's not about you. You know, I'm pointing the microphone at someone else. And that made writing this memoir a real challenge because I am the center of attention in this book. This book is about me. even if in a way I feel like it's kind of a memoir told through the lives of others, because so much of what I'm doing is weaving together the stories of people I've met who've shaped my life.
The Best Strangers in the World, Stories from a Life Spent Listening, All Things Considered, host Ari Shapiro with us. Ari, Nina Totenberg, Supreme Court reporter for NPR, a huge mentor. We've all that have, you know, known her for decades know the incredible things and she and her fellow founding mothers accomplished at NPR. What did she do specifically for you to help you move in this direction of journalism, which was not the plan when you interned at NPR?
Yeah, I wouldn't be who I am if it were not for Nina. Nina was the first person who opened the door for me to set my foot in NPR and journalism specifically. I was rejected for an NPR internship, and then Nina allowed me to intern for her. And she taught me kind of the building blocks of journalism as I transcribed her interviews. I listened to the way she structured those conversations and the way she asked questions. And then when my internship was coming to an end, she actually hosted a dinner party where she knew that I loved to cook. And so she invited me to cook for her guests and also be a guest at the dinner party, where she invited a bunch of powerful Washington VIPs who could conceivably give me a job. I ended up not getting a job to that dinner party and instead getting a temp position on Morning Edition, which turned into a permanent position. And long story short, I've never left NPR. But I owe a tremendous amount to Nina. She remains a dear friend and a mentor to this day.
What was it, salmon and croat or something that you made?
Something like that. Salmon Wellington.
Our salmon 20 Wellington.
20 years later, the salmon Wellington remains emblazoned in my memory.
Ari, I always wondered how you joined up with Pink Martini singing with the group. I didn't realize you'd been a fan of them since, you know, growing up in Portland, and the story of their inviting you to join the group. There's so much wonderful detail about that, but briefly share what that was like for you to get an invitation to sing with them on stage first time.
It was not only surreal that first time, it is still surreal to meet all of these. It's been 13 years now, and I still can't believe I have the incredible privilege to sing with this band that when I was in high school, and they were this little local Portland band that nobody outside the city had heard of, I would sneak into little bars and clubs that I wasn't old enough to get into just to hear Pink Martini perform. And so when many years later, they asked if I would record a song on their album, it seemed like I was going to wake up from some dream at any minute. And then when I finished recording that song and Thomas, the band leader, said, well, we need to find a time for you to perform live with us. So why don't you come to the Hollywood Bowl? Even if listeners know that I sing with Pink Martini, they may not know the first place I ever sung live with Pink Martini was at the Hollywood Bowl in front of more than 17,000 people. And so for that reason, LA will always have a very special place in my heart.
Well, and having been on that stage on a number of occasions, and you look out at that audience, it's daunting. There's just you're obviously you're on the radio with so many more people than fill the Hollywood Bowl. But Ari, you don't see those folks.
Exactly. It is daunting, but also it is so exhilarating. There's something about the Hollywood Bowl where it doesn't feel like people are sitting with their arms crossed saying, impress me. Mm-hmm. It feels like people are showing up in like the backyard of the city, the collective outdoor living room where people picnic, where they've been going since their grandparents were children. And so to be a part of that legacy feels like you're being supported and uplifted and embraced. And yes, it's terrifying, but it's also really thrilling.
Beautifully said. Ari, thank you so much for being with us, sharing about your new memoir, The Best Strangers in the World, Stories from a Life Spent Listening. We'll look forward to hearing you later today on All Things Considered. Ari, thank you so much.
Thanks for having me, Larry.
Ari Shapiro, host of All Things Considered, with us on Air Talk. Thank you so much for your support of Air Talk on LA's 89.3. Yesterday, LA County Supervisor Lindsay Horvath, the newest member of the board, joined us. She and her colleague Ilda Solis had introduced a measure that in unincorporated areas of the county would have provided a number of what supporters of the move call renter protections. Those who are property owners see it as highly intrusive and challenging to them to be able to operate economically as well. But what we heard from the supervisor were grave concerns that if landlords are able to start evicting people again, that that is going to lead to a massive increase in homelessness, and it's going to be hugely disruptive in a negative way to life here in Los Angeles County. Joining us to share the property owner perspective is Dan Uchelson, Executive Director and CEO of the Apartment Association of Greater Los Angeles. It's a nonprofit that represents rental property owners. Dan, thank you for joining us again. We appreciate it very much. The supervisor was very disappointed that the measure didn't end up passing the board because she says that this is going to lead to a dramatic increase in homelessness. What's your organization's response to that?
Well, Larry, we've had homelessness in the county of Los Angeles since I was a young child. And despite the past 3 years of COVID lockdowns and COVID moratoriums on evictions and rent increases, the homelessness population just continues increasing. And the reason people are living on the streets today is not because they're getting evicted from their apartments. If you look at the homeless population, invariably they have mental illness, they suffer from addiction, they've been abused. And the county, after all these years, has never really fully deployed programs that help these people. And they are not doing anything to get these people off the street. And it's a crime, really. And a lot of money has gone wasted today trying to build condominiums to house the homeless, but it's just not working. And they need some out-of-the-box solutions. And it's sickening what we see on our sidewalks in the county of Los Angeles today.
One of the things that we hear from professionals who work with those living on the streets is that, yes, addiction, of course, is a very serious problem, as is untreated mental illness. But in so many cases, what was the precipitator of the person ending up on the street and in a downward cycle of homelessness was not being able to afford the rent or being evicted from where they were living. So then they might go to live in their car. That's the next step. And then if that's not feasible, staying with friends or acquaintances. And when that doesn't continue to be effective, ending up on the street. So the argument is that often what is the first step in this process to homelessness is the person being evicted and losing the place where they're living, either because they can't afford to pay with rental increases, or they've lost a job, or they've been evicted because the landlord intends to get higher rent or do something else with the property. So, you know, why shouldn't there be some protections in place that are additional during this difficult time?
Yeah, Larry, the reality of it all is we are in the housing business. We're not in the eviction business. And the eviction process in California takes 5 to 6 months. And if an owner is successful after spending what could be $20,000 to $50,000 to recover their unit, it could take another 2 months after that for the sheriffs to conduct a lockout. No one wants to go through that process. It's too costly and time consuming, and nobody wants to put families out on the street. And the fact is, according to a Princeton study, that California has the lowest eviction rates in the country. It's something like 2.2 per 1,000 people. And it's by far the lowest in the country. And, you know, the issue is really providing wraparound services. And if you look at where the homeless people are coming from, invariably they're coming from out of state. We have influx of people coming across our border. The state is emptying the prisons. Where do you think these people are going? And it's not because these poor independent rental property owners who, like me, own 4 units and are trying to scrape by to stay in business under the pressure of all this government regulation and hyperinflation and supply chain issues, making it nearly impossible to stay in business. And it's really you know, people aren't getting evicted if they can afford to pay the rent. And so why isn't the government stepping up and helping people afford their rent? They need to provide rent subsidies to people to deserve it, not pass these regulations that apply completely across the board to people like Lindsay Horvath, who makes $280,000 a year as a supervisor and lives in a rent-controlled apartment.
Dan,
is that fair?
Dan is executive director, CEO of the Apartment Association of Greater Los Angeles. One of the things that we hear from those who research the population of people living on the street is that they are overwhelmingly from Southern California, from the area. There are some people that come from outside, but that's not the majority, is those who have done the studies of that. So, Dan, there's a $45 million fund that's been established by LA County to help mom-and-pop property owners make back some of the money that they've lost through non-payment of rent during the pandemic. And Lindsay Horvath, the supervisor, said yesterday that there haven't been applications for that money. So why hasn't that been?
Well, the reason is the money's not there yet, Larry. What Lindsay and her and the other supervisors passed yesterday was a report back stating where $45 million could possibly come from. The earliest the money could be available is this summer. But if you look at the money and break it down, first of all, it's only supposed to help rental property owners that own four or fewer units. And according to a USC study, over $500 million of unpaid rent is owed today. So this $45 million, of which six goes to administrative costs, by the way, and the rest will be parsed out to different programs, very little actually go to rental property owners who are left holding the bag on this $500 million of rent that's been owed for the last 3 years. And our association believes it's far more than that. It could exceed $1 billion in unpaid rent over the past 3 years.
Dan, what's going to happen with your property owners who are going to be able to start evictions? Do you anticipate that there is going to be a significant increase of people who, for non-payment, will be evicted?
Well, Larry, if you're asking me about eviction filings, those could possibly increase because landlords want to be able to assert their rights and, you know, make tenants, you know, respond to the rent that's owed. But ultimately, in the real world, what we find because of the length of time and the cost of evictions is that owners eventually settle with their renters and they give them payouts to vacate the unit so they could rent to somebody who's more responsible. And no one's getting evicted, of course, if they could pay the rent. And that's where government needs to step in and help people who are in need. They need to means test people and provide rental assistance. And because we don't have enough housing in LA County. We don't have workforce housing. We need to build more and we need to build it quickly. Our members don't create the regulations that put us in the situation that we're in, where rent costs are going up because we don't have enough housing supply.
We're talking with Dan Uchelson, Executive Director, CEO of the Apartment Association of Greater Los Angeles. It's a nonprofit representing rental property owners and residential property management professionals locally. Yesterday, we had L.A. County Supervisor Lindsay Horvath, who was talking about what she sees as the county's needs to have additional protections in place to avoid a raft of evictions coming with the end of the protections that have been there during the course of the pandemic. And we're going to be providing, of course, continuing coverage for this at LAist.com, as well as right here at LAist 89.3. Though, Dan, how much time do renters have to repay the rent that they have not paid during the course of the pandemic? Do they have a full year to repay that?
Yes, there's two different time periods, and it goes into sometime next year. Renters don't have to make periodic payments to repay the rent. They can merely just pay everything at a lump sum on the last due date. And of course, if it's truly COVID rental debt, they have no risk of being evicted for non-payment of that. It's merely a monetary claim that landlords would have to go into small claims or civil court to try to get a judgment for.
Thank you, Dan, for being with us. We appreciate it.
Thank you, Larry.
Dan Uchelson, Executive Director and CEO of the Apartment Association of Greater Los Angeles.
The journalists of LAist work for you.
I'm LAist correspondent Josie Huang.
LA's Chinatown is a neighborhood in flux.
I tell the stories of recent Asian American immigrants and families who've been here for generations.
I can never forget where I come from.
How they navigate being Asian and American.
But her landlord has ordered the tenants, mostly Asian immigrants, to move out so she can renovate the property,
and how that shapes LA's future.
LAist, independent journalism, fact-based journalism.
I sure hope you're going to be able to join me. Just six nights away, we'll be at Caltech's Beckman Auditorium on Wednesday night of next week, 6:30. And we will have six of our COVID doctors who've been with us throughout the course of the pandemic. I hope you can come out. They're going to have a lot to say, not just about the evolution of our knowledge about COVID-19, about the effects of the pandemic's public health measures, but how their jobs, how their profession has been affected, you know, particularly for those who are infectious disease experts like Dr. Peter Chin Hong. Also, we're going to have with us Dr. Kimberly Schreiner from Huntington Hospital and so many others, Dr. Shruti Gohill of UC Irvine School of Medicine and Medical Center. We're going to have a whole team of experts, and I hope you'll come join us in the audience. It's going to be a great night and a chance for me to get to know our COVID docs so much better, most of whom I've not met in person, despite all the wonderful conversations that we've had over these past 3 years plus. You can get your tickets to the event next Wednesday night at Caltech's Beckman Auditorium by going to LAist.com/events. Make sure you reserve your seats, and we look forward to seeing you there. Well, California has been home to some of the most well-known serial killers in the nation. Names like the Zodiac Killer, the Night Stalker. They bring chills down the spines of those of us who have lived lifelong and for many decades in California. Serial killings used to be big news and an almost continual series of serial killings themselves. Now, though serial killing isn't completely gone, we had a string of murders just last year in Stockton, for example, it seems that having these sorts of long-term homicides carried out by a single individual have become rarer and rarer. Why is that? Joining us is forensic neuropsychologist and associate professor of psychology at Pepperdine University in Malibu, Dr. Judy Ho. Professor, thank you so much for being with us again. What are some of the reasons why we don't see the number of serial killings as we did in the past?
Well, Larry, thanks so much for having me on, and nice to be with you again. And this is certainly a very interesting topic and an idea that somehow it appears that serial killers have rapidly declined in the last 3 or 4 decades. And I think that there's a couple of reasons for this. There's a few different theories. Well, one of them is the fact that the science of forensics has grown. So this idea of genetic approaches tracking offenders, the fact that we're more on high alert, the fact that there's more systematic protocols to root out people, especially when they start to commit crimes that are of a violent nature. Some of these types of methods have helped us to get to these perpetrators faster than when they reach that definitional threshold of a serial killing, whether that's 2, 3, 4 or more kills.
And DNA just has to be a huge factor. I think of during the time of what were called the Night Stalker series of crimes that were carried out over weeks and just incredibly vicious, unspeakable acts that were perpetrated on people. I would have to think almost certainly that Richard Ramirez's DNA would have, in some of the earliest cases there, led to an identification of him earlier. Do you think that's the case?
Oh, absolutely. I think because there weren't these advanced ways of identifying individuals, DNA, genetics, and also just, you know, this idea of even crowdsourcing, having people, for example, exhibit what we used to call viral or social media justice, right? I mean, sometimes it can go awry, but other times it's like they're being tracked by social media. There's messages and things that they're leaving. People are saying this person looks suspicious, and they point that out. And sometimes it does help law enforcement. So we didn't have any of that back in the Richard Ramirez days. And I think that that's partially why he was able to hide in plain sight for so long.
Also, we have mobile phones, of course. It's easier for law enforcement to track people. It has its own privacy concerns there. But can you speak to that issue of how not just the rise in tech for genetics, but personal technology has affected this?
Absolutely. And I think that the average person probably doesn't realize how much data can be mined from your smartphones these days. You probably don't even want to know. But essentially what we're finding, especially with these more recent murders, is that, you know, people don't usually leave their phone somewhere. They take it with them at all times. And when they think that data is not being tracked, it is. They're monitoring things and can find, after the fact, what kind of search history you had on your phone and on your personal devices, where it was last seen. Even Google searches, sometimes people don't realize that they are doing something that is so atrocious on a Google search, thinking that they're never going to be able to be found out. And we can track Google searches back months and possibly even years in time. And so a lot of times people don't realize that. And then when you look at the timeline of when those searches happen and then when the suspicious activities occurred, the law enforcement has been able to get to a clearer picture much faster.
It's nice we're able to talk about some good news, and that is that serial killings appear to have dropped precipitously within the past few decades, though they still occur. It seems that law enforcement is able to catch the killers more rapidly, and we just don't have the horrific numbers of a single individual or team of individuals carrying out the series of homicides that we have seen in the past. If you have questions for Pepperdine University professor and forensic neuropsychologist Judy Ho, you can give us a call right now at 866-893-5722, or you can email your question to atcomments@las.com. Please include your location and your first name. Professor Ho, what about the ways in which home security has increased? The price of alarm systems has dropped. There's much more competition. The do-it-yourself installations. I have to think that too has deterred individuals from carrying out these crimes.
Absolutely. There's so much video technology that is much more affordable for the average household. And there's also even community watch circles where, perhaps your camera isn't installed yet, but your neighbor's was, and they have actually some degree of visual acuity even in your yard, in your backyard, to the front of your house. And so I think all of these things absolutely help and can deter people, because they think, okay, well, if my actions are going to be caught on a camera, then I'm not going to be able to do exactly what I plan to do in as easy of a way. And when they feel like it's going to be too many barriers, most people will either not do it, or they'll think about doing it in a way that would facilitate the ease of them committing a crime. And so I definitely think that that's a big part of it. I also would like to say that it's possible that we have gotten better at not only detecting, but also possibly reforming potential serial killers. So what I'm talking about is kind of looking forward and looking at troubled youth and people who might suggest that this is a person who could develop into somebody with, for example, antisocial personality disorder, that they're showing some early traits, that hopefully we're able to catch them a little sooner, provide them possibly with services and structure so that they don't actually go down that path. We know that when people commit serious crimes, there's usually a combination of possible genetic and familial risk factors, as well as what's in their environment. And sometimes if we get to them early enough and provide them with the structure and support that they need, they don't go down that road, or at least not as severely.
I wonder, Professor Ho, along the lines of what you're just saying, if also us being more attuned to young people, students who might have antisocial or hostile interactions with their peers because of the terrible spate of school shootings, then maybe that tunes us in to those students who are in the greatest psychological distress. Could that be?
Absolutely. And I think that, unfortunately, there's just too many school shootings, and I feel like we're constantly getting news about that. So I would say that there's a possibility that the statistics have shifted towards these types of killings rather than a serial killing, where this person, you know, they will amass violence on a specific area, usually their own school or somewhere in their neighborhood. And then they're caught and they spend longer periods of time in prison. Sometimes it's for life. And other times they will shoot themselves before the police could get to them. And so then there isn't necessarily this opportunity to then commit another mass shooting after that. So I think that sometimes perhaps the statistics should have been shifted a little bit towards those types of killing. But I also think that sometimes we do identify these troubled youth earlier, and we are able to hopefully get them the help that they need. And sometimes, again, hindsight is 2020, but after a mass shooting happens, we look back at the person's social media. We look back and talk to people that knew the person, and there was a lot of signs that they were mentally troubled and needed help, and they didn't get it in time. And that is unfortunate. So I think that we can do a bit more in that area to try to identify. I think it's hard because we don't want to evade people's privacy. Sometimes we think, well, what if we go to law enforcement with this and then they laugh it off? Or what if, you know, I embarrass myself because they find out that I'm the person who said something about this and actually the person is completely okay. But I always encourage, you know, if you think anything at all is problematic or suspicious, the worst thing that could happen is they investigate and they don't think there's anything untoward. You know, you could save so many lives. And I think that we do have to change that mentality of not looking into our community and saying, what can we do to help? What can we do to support and sometimes report?
All right. I want to thank so much, Professor Judy Hull. We always appreciate your expertise on Air Talk. Thank you so much for joining us today and talk about what's happened with serial killers here in California. Thank you very much.
Thank you so much.
Pepperdine University forensic neuropsychologist and associate professor of psychology joining us on Air Talk. It's Thursday. It's the final segment of Air Talk, and you know what that means. It's TV Talk. I look forward to this every Thursday with our rotating team of expert critics. Today, it's Steve Green of IndieWire who joins us. He's not just TV critic, but associate TV editor for the publication. Steve, great to have you back with us.
I'm so excited to be here. Thank you so much, Larry.
We begin with a series that I don't know how you could be more critically acclaimed than it's been over its three seasons to this point. Succession, which has a fourth and final season on HBO and HBO Max. Brian Cox and the cast are back. Jesse Armstrong, the creator of this series. Have you had a chance to see any of season four?
I have seen a little bit of it, and I am happy to report that it is just as good as it's always been.
That's great. What are the things that you so much like about it?
I think if you hear the premise of the show, children vying for control of their father's company when it seems like he's on his way out, it does sort of bring to mind something like Game of Thrones, another big HBO show from the past. And I think something that show maybe struggled with in its later seasons is it became so much about who was going to win. Succession has done such a great job of making you care about all these individual characters, regardless of success or failure. Seeing them succeed is just as interesting as seeing them fail. And I think that definitely continues in this season. It's the other thing I like about it is that it is this acclaimed drama, but it also is one of the funniest shows on TV, too. So there really is something for everybody.
So great cast, great writing on the series. And it sounds like what you're saying is even in the fourth season, they've been able to play to the strengths of what they developed, which not all series can continue to do that.
No, and I think another interesting comparison point is I Love Billions on Showtime, another show set in the financial world. And I think that show has found interesting ways to reinvent itself over the years, but it is hard hard to sort of see how different characters work in different permutations. There are only so many different alliances and backstabbings you can do before before you kind of run out
of ideas. It becomes repetitive. Yeah.
And so I think the show is ending at the perfect time, even though I'm sure with this group involved, it probably could have sustained itself for two or three more seasons if it wanted to.
We're talking with TV critic Steve Green of IndieWire joining us. Succession, now in its fourth season, episode one of the fourth season, releases this Sunday. So Steve has had a chance to sample it, but the rest of us will, starting on Sunday, and there'll be a total of 10 episodes. It's rated TVMA. The second season of Showtime's Yellowjackets has arrived, set in Canada. Ashley Lyle and Bart Nickerson are running the series, starring Melanie Lynskey and Tawny Cypress. Yellowjackets, what do you think of season two?
This is another show that's interesting to talk about in the perspective of how does it sustain and how long does a show like this last? The first season, I think, hooked a lot of viewers in telling a story in multiple timelines. You have a flashback to the mid-1990s when a plane crashes carrying a group of high school soccer players. They're out in the middle of the forest. They don't know when or how they're going to survive or if they're going to get rescued. And then you flashback to the present where some of the survivors are adults. They're dealing with their own lives, spouses, families, and trying to sort of live life away from the trauma that they experienced in the past. And I think there is a very strong horror element to this. There's a metaphysical aspect to it. And I think those are the things that hooked a lot of people in season one. Season two, I think, takes that foundation and builds it out and sort of becomes three or four different shows at once, which I think is something that is a hard thing for a show to make feel cohesive. But I think it's impressive the way that the show has taken a season one phenomenon and built a foundation that season two and potentially three and four could build on.
Now, Showtime has been folded into Paramount Plus.
Sure.
So this is now going to be available to Paramount Plus subscribers, do you know?
I think that all depends on big, giant corporate decisions. I think eventually you'll be able to sort of fold those in at various times. But
I think Showtime is an add-on currently.
It depends. It depends on your level.
Yellow Jackets, season two of the Showtime series, against rated TVMA, and the first episode of season two releases tomorrow night. There'll be a total of 9 episodes of the second season. The third series is a Netflix docuseries, Emergency NYC. It gives us the lives of emergency healthcare workers in New York. We've seen, of course, many fictionalized accounts of this. What do you think of this docuseries approach?
I really like it. If anyone listening watched Lenox Hill, which is another Netflix docuseries that came out in early 2020, that show followed various employees at Lenox Hill Hospital in New York. It follows surgeons and nurses and patients, just following what it was like to be what it's like to be a day-to-day worker at a hospital like this. The directors and crew that worked on the show were present in the early weeks of the pandemic arriving in New York. So after the first season, they had a sort of special episode looking at those weeks and that time period. And now 3 weeks later, or 3 years later, they're back with another show that takes that Lenox Hill Foundation, follows some of those same healthcare workers and professionals, and expands it out to multiple hospitals in the New York area, and also makes it a show not just about caring for patients when they're at the hospital, but the logistical work it takes to get patients to the hospital.
And this got to be challenging because of privacy concerns, mm-hmm. For people being transported or treated on scene and all. And how do they deal with some of those challenges in Emergency NYC?
Definitely. It's certainly a challenge. There's a disclaimer at the beginning of every episode that outlines that this is being done in the cooperation with not only the patients, but the professionals involved. There is a delicate process of getting permission that the people who are creating the series do go through. And I think what helps is that because you have that cooperation, this is all being presented in a very matter-of-fact way. There's no manufactured drama. There's no artificial, you know, these are life and death circumstances.
Enough real drama there. You don't have to gin that up.
Exactly. There's immense respect for the amount of work it takes, not only to care for these patients under life and death circumstances, but also the emotional work it takes for these doctors and nurses and other medical professionals to console loved ones who are also going through a hard time in knowing that the people they care about are going through this process.
We're talking about the new Netflix docuseries Emergency NYC from the creators of Lenox Hill. The previous Netflix series Steve was talking about, Adi Barish and Ruthie Schatz are the team responsible for this. You get into the personal lives of the responders to the emergency calls?
Yes. And I think that's something that Lenox Hill also did really well, is that it didn't just focus on everything that is in the hospital. It's impossible to talk about a brain surgeon's work without talking about what they are bringing in, as good as they are and as amazing as they are. You know, everybody is human. They are bringing in themselves and their lives and everything they're dealing with outside. And the show, because you have that foundation of knowing who some of these people are, it makes a really nice companion piece and sort of continuing that story forward.
That's great. Steve, thank you so much for talking with us about Emergency NYC. We appreciate it, and we'll see you next time.
Absolutely. Thank you so much, Larry.
Steve Green is Associate TV Editor for IndieWire. We were just talking about the Netflix docuseries Emergency NYC. It's rated TVMA, as is Netflix's Practice, all 8 episodes. We'll be releasing next Wednesday, March 29th.
I'm Julia Paskin, host of Weekend Edition. Join me as I talk with NPR's Sarah McCammon about her new book, The Ex-Evangelicals, Loving, Living, and Leaving the White Evangelical Church. She's not alone in leaving the church. She's found she's among a rising generation fleeing the fold. That's April 25th at the Crawford in Pasadena. Tickets at laist.com/events.